Good evening. My name is Deanna, and I am an alcoholic. My goodness. My goodness. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come and participate in Miracles Happen. I'm going to tell you a little bit, maybe 5 minutes, about how Miracles Happen happened. I know you saw it in the slideshow, but I was there in person. And I can tell you that it's a miracle that it's still happening. I got a phone call probably, I would say, the end of July 1987 from a gentleman named David J., David Johns, also known as David Buck. And he said, "We've been thinking about starting an AA convention for gays and lesbians in Orange County." And back in 1987, it wasn't quite as easy or open as it is today in Orange County. And so he asked me if I would be willing to be a part of that, and that he was going to have a meeting at his house. And so I went to the meeting, and I would say there were probably a dozen people there. And we all agreed that it was a good thing to do, to start a convention, an AA convention, for gays and lesbians in Orange County. There was really, I think, only one other convention that was gay and lesbian, that was Living Sober, which is where they got the idea to start this convention. I think San Diego Feeling Good started the same year as Miracles Happen, and there's several of them now. I mean, I think there's one of the ones on the East Coast also has probably 25 years. And so we met at David's house. We talked about what are we going to do, when are we going to do it, how are we going to do it. We started with $0. $0. And after the meeting, we had about $15. And we decided it didn't matter that we were going to go ahead anyways because it was the right thing to do. And so we had the meeting, and David got elected the first chair, and he then asked for volunteers to be secretary and treasurer and et cetera. And so he asked me if I would be willing to be secretary, and I said I would be delighted, and thank you for asking. And so I was secretary of Miracles Happen in 1988 and 1989. We started the first one. It was the same time of the year in 1988. And everything was donated. Everything was donated by people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, we had very little money. We relied a lot on people getting rooms here so that the hotel or so that the Aliso Creek Inn, I don't remember, I think that was the same name, the first one, first Miracles Happened was at this location. And so we relied on getting a discount from the Aliso Creek Inn based upon the number of rooms that we could book. And so we did all that, and you know, we made money and had a little raffle, and we didn't have great shows back then. We had amateur hour back then. And it was a wonderful thing to see how gays and lesbians could come together for a cause that was to become what you are enjoyed this weekend. And so I have a place in my heart for Miracles Happen. I have been to every single one, 25 Miracles Happen. And I have seen how people come in and have a safe place to come with their boyfriend or their girlfriend and not be afraid to say they're gay or lesbian. Now it's gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, Q. The program will be bigger next year. Anyways, I feel that it's been a real privilege to be a part of Miracles Happen. I've been involved in other roundups also in Long Beach and LA, and I learned how to do that in Miracles Happen. I learned how to do that in Miracles Happen. And so if one person this weekend has become open enough to feel safe here, then that's why Miracles Happen continues. And so if you don't know, I mean, we had many trials and tribulations when we went to a hotel. They didn't want us because we were gay lesbian. We tried to go to, we had somebody who was on the committee who owned a business that booked hotels, and we tried to get the Dana Point Resort, and they wanted a $20,000 deposit. So we experienced over 25 years that regardless, I experienced, regardless of how I felt that it was necessary and important to tell the hotels that we were gay and lesbian. Otherwise, we would not feel a part of. And so that's all happened. And so if you're here, I hope you feel safe this weekend. I hope you enjoy Miracles Happen. And I hope you come back next year. All right? So that's my little history of Miracles Happen. I'm going to keep this pitcher over here. I might as well just drink out of the pitcher because that's how I drank. What the hell was the glass for? I have to wash the glass. All right. Again, my name is Dan. I'm an alcoholic. The first thing I want to do is thank the committee for inviting me, and I want to tell you that in my little gift bag, there's a Altoids, and if you open it up, it has a little message in there. Curiously strong fact. The strength of Altoids comes from the use of real peppermint oil and, this is very important, the dreams of pregnant mermaids. That's what it say. That's what it say. Do we have any mermaids in the room? Yay, mermaids! The second thing that I want to do is to tell you, when I was very new in sobriety, they told me to sit in the front row. And I said, why? And they said, well, particularly my sponsor would say, you need to sit in the front row because then you might be able to pay attention. You won't see the other 100 people sitting behind you, and you might pay attention. So I'm going to tell you tonight in the sobriety countdown, all of my friends are in the front row on this side. I have friends on that side, but this side has the most sobriety. Are you ready? Patty O, 36. Cindy L, 25. Joe G, my sponsor, 34. Doug P, 21. Jim L, my sponsee, 24. Roscoe, my friend, 39. And Don, my friend, 40 years. I'm a numbers freak, I added it up. 219 years of sobriety. If you're new, come to the front of the room. There's a seat next to Link and another one where the bag is. There's two seats in front. If you want to come up, please come to the front.
And then Patty's offering her lap.
And Patty's offering her lap. And Cindy's offering her lap. I mean, what else more could you want? Ken just did that because he's an honorary lesbian. So I'm here to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. And before I do that, before I start on my story, I just have to be quiet for, you know, 10 or 15 seconds so that I can hope that God shows up and allows me to tell you the truth. In addition to God tonight for me, I had somebody else who is here with me, and it's my mother. She's here. And the reason I know that she's here is because I know that she's here. And number two, one of these pins on here is one of my mother's earrings, and this is my mother's bracelet. And when my mother passed away, my sisters decided that I needed the jewelry.
Oh,
I'm telling you, I'm moving this. So, here we go. I'm going to tell you three facts about my life that are facts. The other, everything else is a fact of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and my opinion. And if it's not your opinion, it's just not your opinion. I don't really care if you agree with me. I don't care if you don't agree with me. Please don't come up to me after the meeting and say, oh, blah, 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 blah. I want to talk to you about that. No, please, if you have that moment during my pitch, call your sponsor. More important, if you don't have one, get a sponsor. So the three facts are, number one, my sobriety date. My sobriety date is May 6, 1984. So I've been sober 27 years. I can't believe it. I never thought it was possible. I thought I'd be the first person out of the group that I got sober with to leave. And I'm the last one that continues to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how that happened, but I didn't drink and I didn't die. So that's how I got the first ribbon on my thing that says old timer. I didn't drink and I didn't die. Then it says speaker, then it says past chair. And I had somebody yesterday said couldn't read the first ribbon, and they thought that it said past hair. I says, yes, it does mean past hair. My hair went past my scalp and right down my back. The second thing that I'm going to tell you is that I have a home group, and it's the Tuesday night closed gay men's stag in Santa Ana, California, and it's been there and in existence for 30 years. We celebrated this year, 30 years for that meeting, and that's my home group. And the third thing that I tell you that's a fact is that I have a sponsor today, and my sponsor is Joe G, sitting in the first row. And Joe has been my sponsor now for 19 years. And so I'm going to tell you about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. So I grew up in Chicago in an alcoholic home. And my father was the alcoholic. My mother was an untreated Al-Anon. I have two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister. My older sister is about 22 months older than me, and my younger sister is 13 years younger than me. So my younger sister was the new house, new baby. So growing up in an alcoholic home, now there's alcoholism on both sides of my family. It doesn't really run in my family. It kind of gallops in my family. So anyways, growing up in that home, here's the first, I'll tell you two things that were the most important things that my mother taught me. The first thing that she taught me and my siblings was, whatever happens in the house, don't ever tell anybody. Whatever happens in the house, don't ever tell anybody. So what did that do for me? I was already a shy little Nelly geeky kid. But what it taught me was that I couldn't tell anybody the truth. So I became a really good liar. I would never tell anybody the truth. And I got so good at it that I believed all of the lies that I was telling. And the problem with telling a lie is I have to remember what I told you. Because you're going to come up to me and say, hey, how did that whatever turn out? And I go, what are you talking about? If I tell you the truth, I don't have to remember. I don't have to remember if I tell you the truth. So that was the first bad behavior that I learned, is never tell anybody the truth. What happened to me with that is I became more introverted than I already was. The second thing that my mother taught my family, my siblings and I, was that, because you see, her father was also an alcoholic, so she was an adult child of an alcoholic and an untreated Al-Anon. The second thing that she taught us was to be quiet. She said, if you're just quiet for another hour or so, your father's going to fall asleep and he won't remember anything he told you tomorrow. So that didn't really encourage me to go out and meet a lot of people because number one, I couldn't tell you the truth. And number two, I would never, if you asked me how I'm feeling, I would never tell you. I would never tell you. Because by then, I didn't want you to reject me for any reason, so therefore I became a chameleon. Dan, how are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing fine, Patty. How are you doing? But I wouldn't tell her I wasn't doing fine. I was dying inside. So that's the kind of environment that I grew up in. I couldn't tell anybody the truth. I couldn't tell anybody about what was really happening in the house with my father's alcoholism and all that stuff. And I couldn't, and I had to be quiet. I had to be so quiet. I was so afraid if I made any noise that my father would wake up and then it would be another argument with my mother and they'd be screaming and yelling and I'd have to go in my room and put the headphones on and turn on the stereo so I couldn't hear them. But what it also did was I was afraid to get up at night and go to the bathroom because my father would hear me peeing. So what did I learn to do? I learned to sit down. And to this day, most of the time I sit down and pee. Makes my house cleaning easier. Rich doesn't know what that means, making the house cleaning easier. I have to clean the bathroom. I don't want to clean up all the splashes. I sit down and pee. So anyways, my father's alcoholism is raging and, you know, I don't have a whole lot of memories of childhood. And I think because I could never tell anybody what was going on and I had to be quiet that I just made up stories. I made up stories. And I can tell you that I have a few memories. One of them is I'm probably between 6 months and a year old, and I'm teething. My baby teeth are going out, and my adult teeth are coming in, and both of my parents stick their finger in a glass of bourbon, rub it on my gums so that I'll hopefully sleep through the night, and, you know, that was the last of my social drinking. That doesn't mean I put it in my bottle, but I think I learned how to be a bartender before I was in kindergarten. Because here's was another fact that my family did. They had neighbors, and my parents loved to play cards. So they would be a card party every weekend. It was three families that were involved. Out of the six people that were my parents and two other couples, five of them were alcoholics. My mother was the only one who was not an alcoholic. So, go to the fridge and get me a beer. Okay. Here's your beer. Oh, make me a mixed drink. A little of this, a little of that, here you go. So I learned how to do all that before I even started to go to school. So I had all of the behavior of an alcoholic without ever taking a drink besides the bourbon on my gums. Because I didn't drink, you know, I would drink the leftover drinks that were when I was cleaning up after the card party was over. And, you know, so I would have a little bit then. Anyways, that's one of the few memories that I have of childhood. I don't have a lot. My cousin has one memory. My cousin is sober. She's 34 years sober. She lives up in Sunland, north of Burbank. And she used to babysit for my sister and I. And so she has a memory about something that my father did that I don't. And I think that's common among alcoholics. I have a coping mechanism that will block those memories because they're too painful. So anyways, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my father came home on a Saturday afternoon. My father worked in a factory for 33 years. He worked on Saturday, most of the time because then he could drink a half a day on Saturday. So he came home Saturday afternoon drunk, which wasn't unusual. So here's my mother's MO. She would nag him until they started arguing. And my father got very angry, and he grabbed me, and he turned me upside down and held me by my ankles and held me out the window. I have no memory of that event. Obviously, he didn't drop me because I wouldn't be here. But so anyways, what I started to do in my family was to do things that made me feel safe, which was whenever they started arguing, I would go in my bedroom, I would put on headphones, I would lay on the floor, turn on my stereo, and listen to Led Zeppelin. Usually Stairway to Heaven, I created a little dance that I could do to that. And I'm not doing it tonight, don't get excited. So anyways, I kind of pulled away from my family. I just didn't want anything to do with them. I had one friend, and the friend that I had an alcoholic father who was worse than my father. So I thought, I don't have it so bad. Because I didn't feel, I was this little geeky Nelly kid with black plastic glasses and tape in the middle and tape on both sides. Because I couldn't, whenever I did anything, I was clumsy and I'd break my glasses. My parents didn't have money to pay for glasses every other month. So I wore taped glasses, you know. And I started to live in a world that totally was not true. You know, I couldn't tell the truth, so I couldn't live the truth. I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I certainly couldn't, I knew way before I came out that I was gay. I knew way before. I didn't come out till I was 31. So what happened in that experience is I pulled more and more inward, more and more inward, more and more introverted. I didn't have a lot of friends. When I went to school, my sister was very smart, and I was above average. But here's the deal. Here's what happened in my family. We would both walk in the door with our report cards, and my sister would come home and she would have all A's on her report card. And I would have 4 A's and 1 B. And my father would look at me and say, "You are stupid." And I never believed that I was stupid, but I couldn't tell him that. I couldn't tell anybody that. So eventually, after 12 years of education, I knew that I was stupid. When I graduated high school a long time ago, 1967, my God, it's been 45 years, I really didn't have a lot of choice of what I was going to do next because the Vietnam War was going on. I didn't have a lot of choice. I had really 3 choices. The first choice was, if I go to college, I can get a deferral and not have to go into the military. Well, by the time I was ready to make that choice, I was stupid. So I knew I couldn't get into college, so that option was gone. It's funny how we tell ourselves things that really aren't true. But growing up in that kind of environment is what I learned. You know, the second choice that I had was to move out of the country. I'd never been outside of Chicago. I thought, what the hell am I going to do? The third choice that I had was to join the military. Yes, 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 yes. So I decided that I was going to join the military, and I joined the Army specifically because my father was in the Navy. And I thought, if I can't get his attention one way, maybe I'll get it the other. Real valid choice, you know. A great idea that I've had in my life, you know. So I joined the military, and yes, if you can believe that, the fate of this country was in these limp wrists. This is something that I started to use about 8 years ago in respect for my really good friend, Miss Bobby. So sometimes I use it when it's warm. Most of the time I just use it. Anyway, so I went in the military. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. And the reason why it was the best thing, because the military taught me, they were structured. They told me when to get up. They told me when to have meals. They told me when to go to sleep. In my family, it was like, you know, we had to see, did my father make it in the driveway or did he make it into the lawn when he pulled in on Saturday afternoon or any day? If he didn't make it in the driveway, then it was another Led Zeppelin night of being quiet, not telling anybody what happened the next day. And so, you know, I was in the military. It was a wonderful thing. I was actually lived in New Jersey for 2.5 years, and it was a great thing. It was a great thing. I found somebody in the military, or somebody in the military found me, and this man became my mentor, and he taught me a lot of things that I didn't know. And I was working in this office. I was in charge of this office, and he would show me what to do. And I apparently did it pretty well because they kept on promoting me and they kept on making me do more things. I didn't want to stay in the military because that's where I really started drinking for me. I could go to the NCO club and have a mixed drink for 25 cents. I could buy a carton of cigarettes for $2.50. And so I started to drink. And it wasn't long after I started to drink that I started to get into trouble because of my drinking. And so one of the incidents that I had was I belonged to this bowling league. And we had a bowling banquet because we won. So we went and got our little trophies and everybody said, well, let's go out for a drink. I said, sounds good to me. So we went out for a drink, and after a drink, they all left. And I didn't. I stayed till the bar was closed. And I had a little Volkswagen Beetle, the old style, that I bought brand new. It cost me $1,900 in 1971. And when I... So anyways, coming home from this bar at I don't know what time it was, because I was pretty much a blackout drinker, I rolled my car. And I don't have any idea how I did that because I was in a blackout and I think I passed out, but, you know, I came to and some of the possessions that I had in my car were strewn about the road, and I rolled all the way over, so I wasn't upside down. But, I mean, I really was upside down, but the car wasn't. So I picked up my belongings and threw them in the car, and I turned the key in the ignition, and it started. I said, oh, yay! And I drove back to base. The wheels were like... I said, now I have a dilemma. I cannot tell anybody what happened, because I can't tell anybody the truth. So I have to make up another lie. Now, why I stopped at the MP's after I got back on base is, you know, my great alcoholic thinking. So I stopped there and I said, you know, I went out with some friends, I drank a little too much, I asked somebody else to drive, and they rolled my car, and when I came to, they weren't there. And they did exactly what y'all did. Yeah, they just laughed at me, and they thought, girl, what are you doing? Didn't happen on base, so they didn't really care. You know, so that's an example of my drinking. I got out of the military in 1971. I went back to Chicago. I stayed with my parents for about 6 months and then said, I gotta go. It was not a good thing to have two active alcoholics in the same home. So I moved out. And then I thought, now I can drink like I want to. I don't have anybody watching me. You know, I got an apartment, I got a little job, and I drank like I wanted to. And 1978, or 1977, actually, my father was diagnosed with cancer. And I'll tell you, my father never went to the doctor, ever. And he only went to the hospital because the doctor would not let him out of the office unless somebody accompanied him to the hospital. And my father was diagnosed with colon cancer, and he had surgery. He went to one chemo session and said, not for me. And for 18 months, he sat in the lawn chair in the driveway where my parents lived and smoked Pall Mall cigarettes and drank. And in November of 1978, he passed away, 51 years old. And, you know, the death certificate did not say alcoholism, but it certainly was. And I think doesn't say alcoholism on a lot of death certificates, but that's what it was. So, you know, by then, my alcoholism had taken off, and I was drinking way more than I ever drank before, and I didn't really care. I said, what the hell did I wait for? And when my father died, because I've had a hate relationship with my father from the moment I can remember until the moment he died, and I said, thank God he's finally off my back. And so I drank and I drank and I drank, and after that I decided I couldn't drink away my sexuality anymore, and I decided that it was Chicago and the state of Illinois that were the problem. And there were no gay people in Illinois. And certainly I couldn't go to my parents and say, hey, do you know where any gay bars are? Wouldn't happen. So anyways, I moved to California in 1979, you know, home of the fruits and the nuts. And many of them in this room. And, you know, if you're not a fruit and a nut, Miracles Happen doesn't care if you're straight. We don't care. You're welcome here. You can't help it. You were born that way. And some of us do recruit. Not me, but some. So I came to California, and I came out in 1981, and I don't think it was 6 months after I came out that I got my first drunk driving. I was on my way home from a lovely establishment in Costa Mesa called Newport Station. I see there's a lot of alumni here. I was picked up on the 405 freeway. I spent the night in Orange County Jail. I was so arrogant and so terrified that I couldn't ask anybody for help because then I would have to tell them what happened and I didn't know how to tell you the truth. I said, you know, I was on my way home from Newport Station. I remember getting on the freeway and I think I know where my car is. So I started walking. It was Sunday, July 5th. It was 90 degrees out. I lost my socks in jail, so I had penny loafers with no socks. I didn't have a hat. I didn't have much more hair than I have now. I walked from Santa Ana to the 405 freeway. Walked on and off the on-ramps for three ramps. Couldn't find my car. reached in my pocket, said, how am I going to get home? I lived in Anaheim. I had 40 cents in my pocket. I didn't have bus fare or cab fare. You know, I had $40 in my pocket the night before. What the hell happened? I walked till I got home probably around 6 or 7 o'clock. And I called somebody, a friend of mine at the time, and told them that I think I was in trouble. It was somebody that it was not a peer. It was an older friend that I had met at a party. I didn't have any peers because I didn't know how to make friends. I knew how to buy you a drink. Will you go home with me, please? Can I go home with you, please? Oh, another drink? Sure. Here's a credit card. Oh, my God, another one of those. So anyways, I finally called the police. Where is my car? Your car is in the parking lot of Wendy's on Talbert and Brookhurst in Fountain Valley. Hopped on my bicycle. Found my car, threw the bike in the trunk, went home, took a nice shower and a bath, and went to sleep. Went to work the next day on a Monday. I was burned. My friend said, what happened to you? I said, oh, I went to the beach and I fell asleep. I couldn't tell you the truth. I had to come up with a lie. You know, now I have to remember that. I have to remember. I had a moment of clarity, and I thought, you know, I might be an alcoholic. I might. So I quit drinking. I quit drinking for 30 days. I felt pretty goddamn good after 30 days. I said to myself, I can't possibly be an alcoholic because my only experience is my father. My father never stopped. I stopped for 30 days. I can't be an alcoholic. So I started drinking again. I drank for 3 more years with desperation. I couldn't not have a drink every day. Every single day I had to have a drink. And every single day that I took a drink, I drank until I passed out. I drank until there was no more liquor in the house, and I would drink vermouth as a drink. I didn't try Taboo like Patio, but my mother had Tigris. I don't even remember that. I love the cap, so I tasted that. But I drank for 3 more years, and I had my last drunk Cinco de Mayo, 1984. At this point in time, I was drinking in Long Beach at the Silver Fox. Was my favorite spot. More alumni. Okay. And I could tell you, now I'm a very good alcoholic. I started drinking on Tres de Mayo to get ready for Cinco de Mayo. And the last thing that I remember from that evening was looking up at the clock, and it was 10:45. Now, I drank a half a dozen drinks before I got to the bar because it was cheaper. So 10:45 is the last thing that I remember looking up. And the next thing that I remember is, where am I? I was laying flat on my back on something. I wasn't quite sure what it was. It was dark in the room. I looked up and saw the little dots in the ceiling. I started to count those, and the lights came on, and I was in the emergency room of Long Beach Community Hospital. And I have no idea how I got there. Not a clue. Now, I can tell you that I finally discovered what really happened because I got a copy of the police report. And 6 blocks from the bar, I had a head-on collision with another car. And I am so, so grateful that that happened to me and that I was the only person that was hurt, the only person. And so in that emergency room, they wanted, as soon as they turned on the lights and I kind of came to, they wanted to release me, and it was like, I don't know, 3:30 in the morning. And I says, oh, please, please, can you keep me here until sunrise? Because I had no way to get home. My car was totaled. So I called my roommate, and while I was waiting at that hospital in that emergency room, I had the most important moment of clarity. You know, and I said a prayer that I believe that every alcoholic who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and stays must say. Doesn't matter what the words are. It doesn't matter what they are. It doesn't matter who you say it to, but you have to say it. I had to say it, and I said, God, please help me. I know that I have to stop drinking, and I don't know how to do that. And the obsession to drink was removed from me that morning in that emergency room in Long Beach. And the obsession to drink has not come back in 27 years. And I have not found it necessary to go out and take a drink. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't want to take a drink. It doesn't mean that I didn't need to take a drink. And many of you probably said, I wish that bitch would take a drink. I just didn't take a drink. And so my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous began then, and I'm going to go through this very fast because I know, you know, I'm just the opening act for the show, so I won't get too excited. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I knew I was an alcoholic. I had no doubt in my mind that I was an alcoholic, but I never believed until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that my life was unmanageable. Now, here I am. Convalescing for 3 weeks because I can't even sit, I can't lay down, I have to sleep in a chair because I crashed my ribs and all kinds of stuff. But my life was not unmanageable. I had a job, I had a car, I had an apartment. I had all the outside things that a lot of people have and that I've had and not had. But my life was not unmanageable at that point. It wasn't until I got a sponsor who asked me a question. He says, don't you go to the bank, get a cash advance on your credit card, and pay your other credit cards? And I said, why, yes, I do that. Why are you asking? He says, well, I think that's a little unmanageable. And I had to say, yes, it is. Now, you know, we'll get there. Don't worry. Step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Again, I didn't have any problem believing that I had a higher power. I just didn't like the one that I got in the Catholic Church. I didn't think I was insane either. My sponsor said again, didn't we just talk about that credit card stuff? And I said, okay. You know, step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And when I asked my sponsor, I says, what does that mean? He says, well, it means that God wants everything, and he's very patient. He'll wait till you can't stand yourself, and then if you're lucky enough to surrender, he'll help you. And I said, okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Now we come to step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and I thought, see you later. And my sponsor gave me a format that's not the one in the big book. My first sponsor got sober in the Pacific Group, and so I had a list of 7 questions that I had to write about. He said, he gave me a deadline, which I thought, not a problem. It's like, you know, a month away. And then the most important thing that he told me, the most important thing that helped me the most, was he says, do not read what you have written. And I said, because? He says, if you read what you wrote, the next sentence you put to pen is going to be edited. And so I had to take a piece of paper, literally, and every time I wrote a sentence, cover it up. Write a sentence, cover it up. Write a sentence, cover it up. And when I was done for that day, I turned the page over and didn't read it. So now we come to step five. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another alcoholic the exact nature of our wrongs. And I said to myself, these are all the secrets that I was never going to tell anybody about. These are all the secrets that I kept about what is the truth and what is not the truth. And I said to myself, and I've said this every single day since then, do I want to do what this guy asked me to do, or should I take a drink? And every day since that moment to this day, I have not wanted to drink more than I've not wanted to listen to my sponsor. And so I did the fifth step. My sponsor tricked me into doing it. He called me Sunday morning. I found this new meeting in Tustin. I think we should go. It starts at 9:02. Bring your inventory. I did my inventory, and I tell you what happened for me in step five. I told him all that stuff. I told it all. I told it all. And I don't think I would have done that had I not covered up what I was writing, because I would have edited it. What happened for me is I knew when I went home that day and got instructions for step six and seven, which if you look in the big book, it's only like two paragraphs. Six says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and seven is humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And so I went home and I read that, and after I read that, I started weeping. I hadn't cried for 20 years. I cried in private, but I couldn't tell anybody that I cried. And I started crying, and I knew what happened for me, my experience again, is I didn't know where I belonged, but I knew that I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I said, all right, it's worked so far. Step eight said, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Where did I get that list? From my fourth step. And I says, when I went out with people or had sex with them or drinks or whatever, I said, I didn't really want to know your name. And so how am I going to make amends to people like that? I don't even know their name. I don't know where they live. But they were on my inventory for a particular reason that God had revealed. And so I learned that to treat people in Alcoholics Anonymous as if I owed them that amend and be kind. And so step nine says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I'm going to tell you a story about this, because this is the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. When I was 2 years sober, I discovered that I was, now my father at that point had been dead 8 years. And what happened for me at 2 years sobriety is I started treating all of the people that I knew, and most of them were just people in Alcoholics Anonymous, a few people at work. I started treating them exactly the same way that my father used to treat me. And I was scared. I was scared. I knew that I had to do something. And my sponsor asked me to do an inventory specifically about my father. And so I did that. And what happened when I read the fifth step to him about that was all of that fear and all of that hatred that I had for my father disappeared. Disappeared. Now Mama owned it. Now it was her fault. Now it was her fault. 5 years later, I went back to Chicago to make amends to my sister, my older sister. She didn't want anything to do with it. She didn't want anything to do with it. So I went back to my mother's house. I was staying with her, and my mother kind of looked at me and knew that something wasn't really correct. She said, what happened? And I said, it just didn't work out the way that I thought it would. She had no idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. She's grateful that I got sober, but she didn't know anything about it. And so she says to me, well, why do you think that your father drank? And I was 40 years old, 6 years sober, and in a nanosecond, I had 40 years worth of resentments to tell her about. because of, well, you see, it was her fault. Up until then, I was not taking responsibility for my own life or sobriety, but it was her fault. And I thought for a moment, because I have a friend who says, when you get a year sober, you have 1 second before you have to respond to anybody. If you're 2 years sober, you get 2 seconds. Instead of somebody saying to me, how are you doing? Fuck you! And I can say, how are you doing? 1 second. I'm doing fine. How are you doing today? So I had 6 seconds to think, and I remembered what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous by going to step studies, by having a sponsor, by working on the steps, by going to meetings, by having commitments. I remembered. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And in another nanosecond, I knew in my heart that if I told my mother about 40 years of what she did wrong, it was going to hurt her more than it was going to help me. And I said to her, Mom, the reason that Dad was an alcoholic is because whenever he took a drink, we never knew what was going to happen. And Mom, I am exactly the same. And 40 years of resentments just fell off my back. And I became a free man in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the most powerful step for me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 10 says, continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admit it. I hate to admit it. I thought I was wrong once, but it was a mistake. But I do continue to take personal inventory, and it starts with taking your inventory. You see, because that's very easy to do. It's very easy to do. And what happens for me when I do that is I eventually see that there's something that you're doing that I can't do anymore, and it makes me angry. And so it becomes my inventory. Step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer was easier for me than meditation. I learned how to pray. I had to get rid of all the Catholic stuff that I learned. I had to come up with my own higher power. My sponsor actually asked me to do a list of what I wanted in a relationship, everything that I wanted in a relationship, and I could even put down a name if I wanted to. So I did. I put down a name and everything else. And then he says, okay, read it to me, and I read it to him. And he says, now what I want you to do is I want you to cross off the name that you wrote down and write this down, G-O-D. He says, that's the kind of God that you're going to need. That's the kind of God that you're going to need, and that's going to be the best relationship you've ever had. And it's true. Meditation. What happened for me is I started to go to retreats. I went to a prayer and meditation retreat for like 12 years, and it was all alcoholics. It was gays and lesbians, and we spent the weekend learning how to pray and meditate, and I learned an awful lot. You know, step 12 says, having had a spiritual relationship as the result, not as a result, as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I really do. I've had a spiritual awakening. All of them has been of the educational variety that I don't even recognize until 18 months or 2 years down the road. Sometimes I wonder, was Bill Wilson's white light episode just somebody turning on the nightlight in the next bed? Could be. That's not been my experience. Mine is of the educational variety. Now, I try to help other alcoholics. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm not. The most important thing about helping another alcoholic is I get to stay sober, regardless of what they're doing or regardless of what they're not doing. My biggest pet peeve in Alcoholics Anonymous today is cell phones. If your phone rings one time, I know it's your higher power calling you. If your phone rings a second time, it belongs to me until the end of the meeting. And I've actually done that to people. Only the people I sponsor. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous changed over the years, and that's just my biggest, it's not even a resentment. It's more like courtesy. It's like I'm very committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think, to me, it appears to be that you don't appreciate it if you're on your phone or texting during a meeting. That's my opinion, like I said. If you don't like it, don't come and tell me after the meeting. Call your sponsor. The last thing that I'll say, and end with this, because I always end with this, you know? I thank God for the opportunity to find Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe that God was ever lost. I was the lost one out there doing what I want to do, when I want to do it, and always had a bottle in my hand, you know? And so the last thing that I say is that I've stolen from somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't think there's anything original, but I say this from my friend Angie, who was Miss Bobby's sponsor. I love you, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Thank you.